Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 441. In this episode, Scott talks with Craig McKeachy about choosing a JavaScript framework.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm talking with Craig McKeachy. How are you, sir?
I'm great today.
I'm pretty stoked about this conversation because you have written a book. You've actually self-published a book called The JavaScript Framework Guide that basically breaks it all down. Like, there's more than just Angular. There's Angular and Backbone and Ember and Knockout and all these different things to choose from. There's lots of information on how to use Angular, and there's lots of information on why Ember is the best, but not a lot of people telling me how to choose which one.
Yeah, I tried to have that different insight. I mean, I wanted to say, too, big fan of the show, so glad to be on, Scott, on the show. But yeah, there's not a lot of information on how to choose, and I think people still are a little confused about things, where things start and where the things pick up. So
There's a lot of choice. There's more choice. Like with Rails, it's like, here's Rails, and you can pick some things, but you have to be pretty sophisticated before you start really swapping out huge chunks of Rails. And with ASP.NET MVC, you know, 80-90% of people use what it comes with. But on the JavaScript side, there's a lot of choice.
Yes, almost an overwhelming amount of choice. And I kind of, you know, I've been a developer for 15 years, and I saw that pain of just, how do I keep up with all this stuff? And which of it, you know, which of this stuff matters? Like, and can't I just use some jQuery? Like, why isn't my old way of doing applications, you know, okay? So somebody explain all this to me. And so that's where the book's coming from.
And why do I need model view controller on the server versus the client? Or
right.
Both, you know what I mean? Like, there's this idea that I've just, and again, I'm talking kind of in the mind of the listener, hopefully.
Uh-huh.
I just learned MVC on the server, and now I have another controller and another whole series of views on the client, and I need to have those working. And people are like, well, does this kill MVC on the server? And then everything moves to the front.
Right. And I think that's an important sort of, you know, I think the best way to explain it is from an architectural perspective. Like, you are probably at this point making a commitment to, I wouldn't say killing everything on the server, but there's a shift in architecture between what I would like to call like a classic, you know, server side MVC framework like ASP.NET MVC, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a client side MVC framework like Backbone, Ember, or Angular. The easiest way to think about the difference to me is, you know, where is the data and the template or the HTML mixed together? So in the case of, you know, ASP.NET MVC, you got your Razor view, you got a view model or a model of some sort, and you're using the Razor template engine to kind of bring that together
mm-hmm.
on the server. Whereas with these frameworks, what you're doing is you're sending that data down to the client as JSON, and you're sending static templates that look a lot like a Razor view.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, chunks of HTML with interspersed dynamic parts to them. And you're sending those templates down to the client. And then in JavaScript on the client side, they're being assembled, brought together in the browser. So the browser is the main meat of the application. The JavaScript code running in the browser is what's bringing those templates and that data together on the client. And so you really are, you're not throwing away what you do on the server, because you still need to serve those static HTML resources. You still need to serve JavaScript files. You still need to do your CSS and so forth. You still need an API, like a web API back there. But you are kind of You know, the people get confused are the people who kind of see their application stuck in the middle where they do a classic ASP.NET MVC application. They're close to the metal. They like it. They render it, but then they start doing more and more, you know, AJAX and calls and more, and the jQuery code in their client becomes bigger and bigger as they try to do more elaborate things on the client. And at some point, that gets to be a little bit of a mess. I mean, we can talk about that more, but that's sort of the idea there.
So you, like, if you start, again, we're using ASP.NET as an example, but this applies to PHP and Rails and kind of any situation where, as you said, on the server side, the HTML meets the data, or the template rather meets the data, and HTML is produced in an MVC or in a classic kind of style on the server. And that comes across when we start adding progressively enhanced bits of JavaScript, whether it be jQuery or plain JavaScript, or as you said, Ajax-y type things, you start blurring the lines about who's really responsible for what, right?
Right. And I think, you know, like, I have this sort of list of telltale signs I go over in the book as to where the line, when you, like, what are the signs that your application is getting to this point, right? Like, where the lines are getting blurred. And, you know, one I like to think about is the templates are being duplicated on the server and the client. So if you think about that progressively enhanced web application you described, mm-hmm. that most people are doing right now, you've got a Razor view on the server, and you may have the same copy of that Razor view in Handlebars or one of the templating engines in JavaScript, and you might have that same template. And so that's very undry, you know, as we're used to. You're really repeating yourself quite a bit there. Same thing with the models, right? You've got this view model or domain model on your server that you're binding into your view up there. And, but then you also have sort of that same state, you know, in the client in jQuery. And, you know, the other, you know, big sign you see is like, I mean, I've done this a million times where you have, like, you're storing database IDs in DOM elements and then, you know, going and, you know, calling find or first on them to get the ID back out so you can go rehydrate the state of that object because you didn't, you know, you don't have all the state, you know, you haven't committed to having your application in JavaScript on the client, if you will.
But some duplication is inevitably going to happen, right? How do you know what's a good amount of duplication? Because the thing is, there's a model, and there's very likely a model of some kind in the database, or at least if you're using an ER type of a situation, a SQL situation. Then there's the model in memory as it moves through the web server, maybe. And then there's a model in JavaScript. Is, you know, you're moving data from one shape to the other. Is the goal to avoid that entirely and just stay in JSON the entire time? Just take it right out of a JSON store, send it right across the wire, maybe a minor transformation, and then JSON all the way to the end?
You know, I don't know that that's necessarily the goal. I think there will be some layers in between, especially as the application becomes more elaborate, as you know, hinted at. You know, you need some layers of abstraction in there. You're not just going to expose your database to the web via JSON or whatever. So I think, you know, you bring up a good point. I think, you know, the problems come in when you're sort of half committed on both sides. You know, you don't have this clear architecture. You know, it's okay if you put some layers in knowing that you're going to need those layers. But mm-hmm. if you're sort of building your app half on the client side in JavaScript and half on the server, that's where, you know, the real problem comes in. And no, it's not a perfect world, Scott, of course, right? Like, these things will definitely have duplication some places. And I think, you know, the one thing that's always puzzling to me that I still haven't come to grips with is, you know, this idea of, is the model that you bring down to the client, you know, via JSON in this, from this web API, is this a view model or is this a real model, you know, a domain model? And so that's something that I've heard even framework authors differ on.
Why do they differ on that? Why are there two kinds of models? Why is the model in the database so different often from the model in the view?
I think it's different. I mean, at least with me, Scott, and I think a lot of your listeners will have experienced this. When I was, you know, building ASP.NET MVC applications, adding that extra layer of a view model became really useful, particularly in situations where you're like validating, let's say you've got a date input and you want to input a date, and you might have that date be nullable because it's not a required field. on the UI, or you might even have it be a required field and have it nullable on the view model. Mm-hmm. But in your actual model in your database, you want that field to be required, you know, to not be nullable. And this leaves you sort of a layer to do sort of UI type validation things and to shape the model based on the UI. Another common example of, you know, that difference of the view model or presentation model versus the domain model is the whole, you know, you need a count of how many items are currently shown on the screen. You know, it's a very view centric type thing. So, I'm not sure if I answered the entire question there. But that's why I think, you know, view models are useful. In terms of, JavaScript and JavaScript MVC, mm-hmm. I see people differing because sometimes some people see the value in that view model. And I think some have not quite realized, you know, that it's needed. Some of the frameworks maybe not haven't realized, or they're not, the terms get mixed, right? People reuse terms, to mean different things. I don't know how to describe that better, but a good example is Ember. A lot of people, if you really study Ember as a framework, the ironic thing is the controller, although it does controller-like things, they have a thing called a route in there as well that's not a router. But long story short, the controller really is sort of like a MVVM view model in some ways, where it's a very view model. It has all the view model properties on it, as well as some behavior. So it's not apples to apples with your server-side MVC framework, you mm-hmm. know, and it gets confusing where's the right place to put things.
It seems like people take Angular, Ember, and then sometimes Backbone, and they refer to them all kind of at the same time. And you see lots and lots of articles where it's this versus this versus this. It's Angular versus Backbone versus Ember. And one of the things that comes up a lot is this notion of being opinionated. Some frameworks, I think Ember is probably a good example, that says, we are unapologetically opinionated, right? Like, here's the way you write applications. And then others, and I would probably use Backbone as an example of one that's a little bit like, eh, you know, here's some things. Enjoy. You know what I mean?
And I think, you know, to say that it's a little bit unopinionated is an understatement, right? Like Backbone has almost like, it can be almost frustrating at times how little opinion it has. But sometimes people, you know, I think some developers just love this, right? The guy that likes to invent things, the developer that likes to invent things, this leaves them a lot of freedom, you know? Right. So yeah. And that's definitely true in terms of opinionated and convention and stuff. Ember's the most convention over configuration, opinionated framework, mm-hmm. very much out of the Rails community and so forth.
Do you think that's because of the people who wrote these things? Like, should I read into the men and women who worked on these projects and say, oh, I like this programmer because they're really opinionated, therefore I will like their framework? You know, should I be making my decisions on my framework based on where myself, like how much guidance I want on my own personal slider bar from to super opinionated?
Right. I think that's definitely something it's an input in the formula, right? Like there's so many facets to choosing one, but that is one that I do bring up, you know, in the book. It's one that I've written about online, and I think a very valid one. Like, people should realize, you know, who wrote these things? Who are these people? Mm-hmm. What background do they come from? Do they agree with their opinions? You know, what other frameworks were they inspired by and so forth? You know, I like to, you know, one thing I like to talk about is, you know, whenever you hear like a great musician who just like, maybe not a great musician, but a musician who just, you know, put out an album or something like that, mm-hmm. They get interviewed by a journalist, and the journalist often says, you know, who were your influences when you were growing up? You know, that sort of thing. And I think that, there's a similar thing to be learned online about, JavaScript MVC frameworks. So for example, if you look at AngularJS, WPF and Silverlight and Flex are named as major influencers of those. So if you're, you know, in that camp where you're sort of afraid of the future of some of those technologies or, or, you know, you want some, needs a more web-centric, you know, technology stack for whatever reasons in your corporation, you can feel pretty good that, that the very declarative nature of WPF and Silverlight type apps is what you're going to get if you choose Angular.
I really like, just backing up just a little bit, I really like the idea of looking at the people's influences. I like that analogy. I mean, you might listen to a musician and go, yeah, you know, I can hear that Jimi Hendrix influence there, you know. Rarely do I hear that kind of stuff amongst web developers. I don't know if it's a lack of a sense of history. I think that amongst language wonks, amongst F-sharp people who might say, oh, yeah, well, you can definitely see the, you know, the OCaml, you know, influence in that particular language feature. I maybe I'm not listening to the right people. I hopefully am not speaking incorrectly here, but I don't hear that a lot. And I like that idea that that is a, another input, as you say, into the formula that, like, you know, what were they influenced by? What kind of an application were they building? That's another great question. When so-and-so built Ember, they built it for a reason. Like when DHH built Rails, he was building it as a generalized thing, but he was also building Basecamp, right?
Right.
So he had a reason to build this.
Yeah, I think that's a good to understand, you know, where these people are coming from. I think when Jeremy Ashkenas built Backbone, you know, he was largely in a jQuery or plain old JavaScript world, and he was just improving the world he was in, which was, you know, I've got jQuery and I'm really good at JavaScript, but I'm still writing a lot of repeated code over and over again. And I like these, I'm embracing these micro frameworks. I like the fact that, you know, I want a really light framework and I want a really unopinionated framework because I know what I'm doing here. You know, so that's another example. And then the Rails one is what you said with like DHH and, you know, convention over configuration. You know, ASP.MVC is, you know, based on these same ideals or whatever. And I think, you know, that's what you're going to get with Ember. I mean, it looks scarily like, you know, the Rails APIs, right? When you look at it, and it's so Yehuda Katz and Tom Dale are the major, you know, public figures on the Ember project. And they came from, you know, Yehuda Katz was is on the core team or was on the core team of Rails. He was also on the core team of jQuery, or is, not sure. But, but you can see their influences, you know, there. So just looking at that and saying, hey, which one of these guys, you know, which these past technologies do I associate with? Not to beat this to death, but another interesting thing that a lot of people don't realize is AngularJS came, a large influence from the Java community. In particular, what people love about it is its testability and, the dependency injection and all those IOC containers, like, in particular, the authors will mention Juice when they talk about the inspiration for AngularJS, which is a popular IOC container, used at Google quite a bit in Java server side applications. So, you know, they were saying, hey, we like to write our applications, you know, have them be testable. And the way we achieve this is through IOC containers and dependency injection. So we're going to build a framework that makes that really easy to fall in the pit of success with that.
And I think it's important to point out that we're not talking about overly focusing on individuals or individual personalities, but rather, in my opinion, on the values that were valued at the time that someone wrote these things. You know, what was the thing that they valued? I'm not trying to make a value judgment saying that, like, oh, Rails is good or oh, Rails is bad. But if you like their API, if you value their design style, if you find their aesthetic attractive, then this JavaScript framework might be more interesting to you, right? Like,
right.
I use it in the analogy I've used a lot about, hey, you like Rails? You like Ruby? Maybe check out CoffeeScript because it's CoffeeScript is kind of what a Ruby person would like JavaScript to look like. Hey, you like C sharp? Maybe look at TypeScript because it's kind of what a C sharp person wishes JavaScript looks like. So if you really are enamored with Rails or if you really are enamored with, you know, Silverlight style development, maybe look at this framework or look at that framework. So thinking about the individual is one way to look at it. But the other way is, what do you value and does it align with what those other frameworks value?
Right. That's exactly the point. That's great. That's great.
Is that true? Okay, good. Well, I'm glad. I was just making that up. Okay, so in your guide, do you have an opinion? Do you let your opinion leak, or do you try to be agnostic?
You know, I have an opinion. I try not to let it leak because, you know, just to give you a little background on myself, my dad was the editor at a small town newspaper, mm-hmm. and I was a journalism minor in college. And I think, you know, one of my sort of innate strengths is being able to be unbiased about things, but that doesn't mean not having opinion or reporting exactly what is really going on with things, but it just means not being like too much of a blind fan of a given framework. So I think, you know, I'm able to look at each one and say, you know, I don't like that about Backbone, that it's unopinionated, but here's why it would, you know, here's the kind of person that would like it. And instead of just, you know, talking poorly about it because, you know, it's not me, I try to kind of keep an even keel in, like, there's a chapter that's a pro and cons of the frameworks, and just sort of lists out pros and cons of each framework, because it's not a simple, you know, formula like this one is the greatest and write off all the other ones. It's more of a, you know, what's right for your project, what's right for your resources, what's right for your aesthetics, you know, as a developer, all these kind of things really figure into it. The philosophy thing and the inspiration thing we talked about before, stuff like that. So I talk a lot about that stuff. So I like to think, you know, I give up strong opinions in the book, but I try to stay unbiased.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about kind of the elephant in the room, which is just JavaScript, just vanilla JS? You know, why do I need a framework? And I know that for some people, they still love jQuery. For others, people are starting to feel that jQuery is kind of falling out of favor for vanilla JS. And there's even joke websites like vanilla-js.com that I use in my talks to remind uh-huh. people of, hey, folks, you don't need so many abstractions.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are frameworks like Backbone. If you're a person who leans that way, let me put it this way. My opinion is you need something, mm-hmm. right?
Why?
You're using ASP.NET MVC and not using classic ASP, or you're not writing C++, what was the old thing? The old IIS plugins.
Oh, iSAPI plugins.
Yeah, iSAPI was the word I was looking for, Scott. You came up with that. That takes me back. But you're not writing iSAPI plugins anymore. You know, you need some level of abstraction. It's just whatever level are you comfortable with mm-hmm. Taking on the responsibility for, and which, you know, when you play with these things and you use these applications, which one doesn't make you feel constrained too much?
Constrained by their opinions?
Right. Because, you know, these frameworks could go so far as to do a lot for you. Like, you know, I don't want to get into this debate, but, you know, like at some point, web forms, you know, became the villain, you know, in the world. And...
Web, you know, again, that's a different conversation, but I will say that web forms has value. It's just a different kind of value. You know what I mean? Like, there are people out there still making great applications in VB6. They just may not necessarily be the kind. Trying to get an old style framework to fit into a new world is definitely not reasonable, right?
Right. And I'm not saying like, me saying that wasn't about trying to say, you know, web forms is bad. It's more saying it's a higher level of abstraction than ASP.NET MVC.
Exactly.
And so,
exactly.
And I think there are the frameworks are perfectly valid for different types of developers doing different kinds of jobs and so forth. So it's the same thing applies to these frameworks, right?
Now that's interesting. So that's good. So the level of abstraction at which you choose to work at kind of dictates what you're going to be thinking about and the kinds of problems that you're going to be solving. So for example, web forms is a way of hiding some of the statelessness, or most of the statelessness and the tediousness of HTML and HTTP and how it works. Angular, Backbone, Ember, do they hide things from you, and are they hiding HTTP things, or are they hiding JavaScriptisms? Like jQuery hid, you know, a lot of the complexities between browser implementations. They invented the CSS selector concept. jQuery made that kind of a non-issue for a while. There was a time there where just simply getting a DOM element was a challenge. Those days are over, right?
Right.
And now we have different kinds of problems.
Yeah, I think, you know, one way I like to talk about JavaScript MVC frameworks is to talk about, like, what are the features that are in this JavaScript framework? Like, what is really the pieces that make it up that are value add, right? So,
okay.
A router, for example, is a value add. So, just quickly addressing what a router is in an MVC framework, well, it's exactly what you're used to it being on the server in Rails or ASP.NET MVC, not MVC, you know, it's in web forms now, right? It maps a URL to a chunk of code, at the minimum with these frameworks. So, but what's happening is instead of that router running on the server, it's running on the client. So you're there in JavaScript and you click a link, but instead of that making a request mm-hmm. to the server, you know, the link doesn't actually, it gets hijacked by JavaScript and it says, oh, this person wanted to go here. So what do I want to do because of that? What code do I want to run because of that? And then what do I want to change the URL to reflect that new state that the person is moving to in the application or the new page, you know, sort of virtual page that they're moving to in a single page application. So,
Didn't you say that one of the frameworks used the word router and it wasn't really a router?
Yeah. So it's actually, Ember uses, they have a router. And it is a router as you would expect. Uh-huh. They also have these objects called route objects, which are something that is not seen in any other framework. And people often get confused as to what a route object is, and including myself when I was first learning and what a, you know, that sort of thing. And what a route is, it's sort of, this is a bigger conversation, but in summary, they use it to sort of, wire up their model. Before mm-hmm. the controller starts to work on it, basically. So they use it to go fetch data and do stuff. There's other stuff that it does, but in a nutshell, that's a good way to describe it in Ember.
Okay. So without getting too deep into that though, but the general concepts are the same though. I mean, routes exist, routes responsibilities are clear, as are, controllers and how those things work.
Right. So just to continue with what other features are in, you know, a JavaScript MVC application uh-huh. real quickly, data binding is a big one, right? So this is not an unfamiliar concept to those of us who've worked in richer applications in WPF, Silverlight, et cetera, Windows forms. So you understand what data binding is, but, you know, an interesting point is Backbone doesn't actually have data binding out of the box. You kind of have to write a decent amount of code to get, data binding working. There's plenty of plugins that help you with this, but it's not part of the framework. So it's very, you know, bare bones in that way. But then people often criticize, like, you know, Angular, because, you know, it's awesome when you first do the first demo and everything data binds both ways. But at some point, you know, there can be performance concerns with the data binding. So it's, you know, it's all trade-offs. You know, you've got that great two-way data binding that you're used to on the server. An interesting point is, I believe, you know, in the history of frameworks, like Knockout was the first one to really come with that data binding idea, and Steve Sanderson, you know, that his framework to come out with that idea. And, you know, now a lot of people think of that as an Angular specific thing, especially outside the .NET world, where Steve's known a little better, but I think that's an interesting thing to know. But what's different about Knockout is, at least until recently, it's been pretty focused on just that data binding feature, and sort of a, you know, mm-hmm. when you get applications in a company, you might choose to buy to like a best of breed approach, and you might buy three different applications that are the best of breed in like a CRM and a marketing application and a general ledger system, and then wire them together through integrations, right? Or you might try to, you know, choose to buy a suite where all these things kind of automatically work together. So when you talk about something mm-hmm. like Angular, it's more of a suite where, you know, all these framework pieces are in the box and working together. Whereas something like Knockout takes more of the opinion Okay, there's a lot of good routing libraries out there, like SammyJS and HistoryJS. And use that for that. And then for the data binding, use me over here. And then, you know, for some of these other features, we'll talk about use other things. So, and I think that it's, you know, not as popular as it was at one point, Knockout. And I think they're moving to, you know, adding some more of the features that other frameworks have, you know, to sort of compete in that world.
Mm-hmm. Now, one other question I wanted to ask as we kind of come to the closing here is that there's other things that are kind of more fundamental, like module loaders and things like that. And you know, they started with things like require.js, and now the idea of a module and a module loader are being kind of built into the language. What do I need to know about those and loaders as you know, script loaders as I think about selecting a framework?
I think the short answer is, they all work with most frameworks. So it's just a, you know, pick that as a separate choice. Or, you know, with some frameworks, they have enough, at least they have a lot in that area, like take Angular or Ember in particular. They sort of, Angular has a module concept, which is, you know, modules for .NET people are namespaces. I mean, it's, you know, if you come from the Ruby world, they call them, you know, module, or there's more of a, you know, it's not a one-to-one mapping, but it's essentially a place to organize your code, you know, so that it's not just all floating out there in the global namespace. And so Angular can be a little more confusing when you're first looking at it, but it's very, it's written so that you can kind of namespace everything, without really knowing, being that good of a JavaScript programmer by default, and you kind of fall into the pit of success. And I think that's another reason people, you know, have liked it. And Ember has some of those same traits along those lines. So all that to say, you might not have as much of a need for a module loader with some of those other frameworks. I'm not going to want to get too much hate mail because, you know, there's people who, you know, you still need it. And yes, those frameworks do a lot more. You know, Browserify is a very popular one lately, is what I've been hearing, if you kind of want the latest. But I think they're still evolving, right? Like all those module frameworks, the standards seem to be set, but they're still evolving.
Yeah, it is definitely a challenge to try to figure out what the right decision is. And we talked a little bit at the beginning about all the different people and personalities. And as you start getting deeper and deeper, you think, oh, well, I'll use AMD. That's, you know, asynchronous module definition. And then you poke around and you find blog posts from someone like Tom Dale of Ember, who's like, AMD is not the answer. Like, oh, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time, you know, and then you won, you know, I think, what do I know, right? I'm just the one who wants to learn. So it's difficult. But I appreciate that you've put all of this in a book, and we can go and explore that. And you actually made a website for Hansel Minutes listeners. You can check that out at FunnyAnt, FunnyAnt, just like it sounds, funnyant.com/Hanselman. You got a discount for listeners. That's super nice of you.
Yeah. So for a couple weeks at least, so when you hear this, please try to go right away if you have interest. 20% off for a couple weeks, because podcasts are a little vague on, you know, timing and so forth.
That's
so
true. Podcasts do live forever.
Right. If, you know, after that, if you miss that time window, just go to javascriptframeworkguide.com and you'll get to the same page.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much, Craig McKeachy, for chatting with me today.
It was a pleasure.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.